This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Kathy Fletcher, founder and executive director of People for Puget Sound, a citizens organization formed in 1991 to protect and restore Puget Sound and the Northwest Straits. Kathy Fletcher is here today to evaluate the Puget Sound Partnership Action Agenda, a strategy for cleaning up, restoring, and protecting Puget Sound by 2020. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you. Good morning, Diane.
Would you begin by giving the history of the Puget Sound Partnership and why it was formed?
The Puget Sound Partnership was formed because Governor Gregoire, when she took office originally 4 years ago, realized that despite years of effort that we weren't making sufficient progress in protecting and restoring the health of Puget Sound. When she took office, you might recall the Hood Canal dead zone was a desperate situation. We were having fish kills over there, and it was a stark reminder of how much we still have to do to protect our marine waters and to restore them for the future. So she realized that it was a good idea to bring people together and, you know, make a new push. And it's taken probably longer than all of us would have liked to get to the point where we are today. But she enlisted William Ruckelshaus to lead this effort and initially set up a committee called the Puget Sound Partnership. And I served on that, and we spent about a year rehashing a lot of old issues and old ground, but coming up with pretty much what we've known all along, which is that we need to move ahead in a scientifically based, credible, results-oriented way. And that led to the legislature creating the Puget Sound Partnership as an actual agency. And that happened a couple of years ago. And then the partnership as an agency has been working to develop this new action agenda, which is supposed to be the plan that brings everybody together in a coordinated, strategic way. So that was just adopted on December 1st. And, of course, now the hard work begins.
What has been the process over the past year and a half to come up with a Puget Sound Action Agenda? Could you go into a bit more detail and talk about to what extent the public has been involved?
Well, the development of the Action Agenda and the committee that I mentioned that preceded it, that Governor Gregoire had set up, has had a tremendous amount of public involvement in the sense that there have been lots of meetings and lots of opportunities for people to tell the partnership what the issues are and what we need to do about them. Unfortunately, by the time the partnership got to the point where they really knew what they were going to put in the action agenda, they were running out of time. So the final action agenda that was adopted had a very quick turnaround time between draft and final. And I think that was it was what they had to do given the time they had left, but it was kind of poor planning because it could have stood some additional public involvement. Interestingly, the EPA, the federal EPA, is a player here because a lot of the funding, both existing and anticipated, for Puget Sound is going to come through the EPA. And they have the ability to approve or disapprove the action agenda from their standpoint. And they've, in their comments, said that in order to gain their approval, there needs to be a more complete and thorough and opportunity for public comment. So along about March, there'll be another opportunity for the public to scrutinize the agenda and offer more comment. All of this is to say that the action agenda itself is still a work in progress. And so not only will there be more public opportunity, but there's a lot that isn't there yet that still needs to be developed, not only with the participation of the public, but with the experts as well.
Before we go into more detail, would you give a general overview of the action agenda as it now stands and what was accomplished?
So the action agenda, as I said, there's been a lot of replowing of old ground. You know, we've been pretty much aware of what the problems are that confront Puget Sound. But the action agenda once again summarizes what we know about the health or lack thereof of Puget Sound. And unfortunately, mostly it's the lack of health. And they lay out both what the major threats are, and that can briefly be summarized as pollution and destruction of the land or the habitats. So the threats and then what to do about it. And they've asked the what to do about it question in two ways. One, what do we need to do about it in a comprehensive way? And where do we need to start as a kind of priority setting question? So that's what the action agenda does. They are required by the statute that the legislature passed to come up with a plan that actually will restore the health of Puget Sound by the year 2020. So this is the first time we've had a deadline. All previous efforts have been somewhat open-ended in that regard. And in aiming toward that deadline, the action agenda is supposed to put out the benchmarks and the indicators and the definitions of progress that we will be tracking. We all will be tracking, the public as well as the implementers, the agencies, and so forth. And that part of the action agenda isn't there yet. So it's a big piece of important work that remains to be done. So if people are reading it and looking for, well, how are we going to measure whether we're getting there, that part isn't there yet.
What has been the discussion around what the benchmark should be?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion, and this has involved the scientists as well, as to what is a healthy sound. You know, some people kind of get hung up on that first question, you know, how can we restore the health of Puget Sound if we haven't really defined health? And there's been a lot of good work by the scientists to try to say what that means, but it's still at a pretty general level in terms of what's in the action agenda. But the scientists are actually coming up with numbers, for example, contamination levels or cleanup levels that might define health, population numbers for critical species, acres of healthy habitat. These are numbers that nobody has in their head, and it is still in draft form. I think everybody who lives here has an intuitive sense of what a healthy sound is. It's a sound that sustains not only the people and the stuff we like to eat out of Puget Sound, but it sustains the orca population. It brings back the salmon runs. It's a self-sustaining ecosystem that is on a course of improvement rather than an ecosystem that is in a state of continual decline and leaving us species on the brink of extinction. So I think, you know, people have a pretty good qualitative understanding of what a healthy sound is. What the partnership and the scientists are trying to do is to put some numbers on that so that we can track that over time and see if we're getting as far as we need to go.
Could you briefly summarize the state of the sound right now?
So the state of the sound right now is, I use the word crisis. The sound is in crisis. The partnership uses some similar dire words in talking about the sound. And I think we need look no further than the state of the orca whales to really understand what's going on out there. Most people are aware that just in the last year, 7 whales in the local resident population disappeared and are dead. When they disappear, that's not a good sign. That doesn't mean they've moved to California. That's almost 10% of the remaining population, which has already been officially designated endangered. But orca whales, we love them. Is that the same as saying what the health of Puget Sound is? Well, the reason it is the same as saying what the health of Puget Sound is because they're at the top of the marine food chain. So they depend on the salmon runs, and they're not getting enough salmon to eat. The salmon depend on the herring and the other small, what we call forage fish. Those fish populations have crashed. The salmon aren't getting enough to eat. And all of the critters up and down the food chain are getting way too much toxic pollution into their bodies. And those at the top of the food chain, of course, are suffering the worst, and that's the whales. So it's a situation in crisis. We've got endangered species, not only the whales and the salmon, but other critters such as birds. And to bring it back really home, we people are also suffering from the same things that are affecting Puget Sound, not only in terms of toxic pollution and our ability to eat things out of Puget Sound and to swim in the sound and to use the sound the way we would like, but in a lot of ways, I think Puget Sound is our soul here in this region. And that's a kind of maybe a woo-woo kind of an idea. But when you think about it, our quality of life and even the, you know, cold, hard dollars of it in terms of the value of our property around Puget Sound, all of these things are related to the health of Puget Sound. So it's in a crisis. It's going downhill. The continued growth of population and the way we do development, in spite of all the talk about how we should do it, mean that we will lose Puget Sound. It's in some kind of final stages of a tipping point, and we don't really know exactly what that tipping point is. But unless we are able to mount a huge effort quickly, we could lose it.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Kathy Fletcher, founder and executive director of People for Puget Sound. Our topic is the Puget Sound Partnership Action Agenda, a strategy for cleaning up, restoring, and protecting Puget Sound by 2020. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you elaborate a bit about the threats to Puget Sound?
The threats to Puget Sound can pretty generally be summarized as pollution and destruction of the habitat, both on land and in the water. Well, what that really is saying is that in the pollution area, we have a legacy of contamination of toxins that are mostly in the sediments underneath the water. And so these are the PCBs and the toxic flame retardants, PBDEs, and it's a whole alphabet soup, but the byproducts of the use of fossil fuels, the polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons being a word most people understand as being associated with oil and coal and the like. These toxic contamination sites in Puget Sound are a historic legacy, but the really bad news is that we continue to have toxins flowing into Puget Sound, most of which are running off the land in the form of stormwater runoff. And that really is two problems in one, because we are putting the pollution on the land and making it available to be washed off into Puget Sound, the drips from our cars, the pesticides we put on our yards, and so forth. But we are also paving over the landscape so that pollution that might otherwise, with the water, seep into the ground, a lot of the pollution, in effect, be trapped and not get into the water. We've interrupted that process, and so we no longer have the water being caught by the vegetation, seeping into the soils, replenishing the groundwater, and feeding the streams over the summer. We're just washing that rain directly into the streams and lakes and into Puget Sound. So we've not only created the pollution on the land, but we've created the way for that pollution to get maximally into Puget Sound. So that's pretty much the pollution story. We also, of course, have pollution coming in from pipes from our huge sewage treatment plants like the plant at West Point and from factories, oil refineries and other factories around Puget Sound. Septic systems are a big problem as well, and not so much the toxic pollution, but putting in what we call nutrients like fertilizer that are causing the algae blooms that then deplete the oxygen and kill the fish. So the pollution issue is a big one. It's partly historic. It's partly ongoing, and a lot of it is tied to our paving over of the landscape, which is a bridge to the other issue, which is the destruction of habitats around Puget Sound on the shorelines and also upland. As we develop and think to accommodate more population, we have to plow under more and more and more land and turn it into housing developments and shopping centers and freeways. We are losing the land that really supports a healthy Puget Sound. And without vegetation, without soils, we will simply not be able to reclaim the health of Puget Sound. And so these issues of growth and development, and then the pesky issues of, for example, if you live on the shores of Puget Sound and you build a bulkhead and you strip the trees off your land and you completely change that shoreline landscape, you are destroying the very habitats that support the herring and the little fish, which in turn support the salmon. And even though each person's contribution to the problem may look really small, it's adding up tremendously to the point where of the 2,500 or so miles of Puget Sound shoreline, we've actually bulkheaded or put walls or riprap along 800 miles of Puget Sound shoreline. So we've all contributed our share to the problems, but I would particularly point to the shorelines as a place where we've lost a tremendous amount of healthy habitat, and we need to get a lot of that back.
What are the partnership's recommendations on the actions that must be taken to move from where we are today to a healthy Puget Sound by 2020?
Well, interestingly, the action agenda, like every other Puget Sound plan before it, is a really long list of things, and even on a nice long interview like this, we couldn't possibly do it justice. But suffice it to say that they have listed some specific big projects like removing the Elwha dams, which are preventing the legendary Chinook salmon run from coming back on one of the most important salmon streams in the Puget Sound area, to reclaiming the Nisqually Delta, another huge restoration opportunity. So they've mentioned some specific big things that need to be done. And then they've talked about some kind of systematic things that need to be addressed, such as the management of stormwater, which can get pretty techno-boring pretty fast. But basically, we need to make sure that when we develop land, that we retain the ability of the soils and the vegetation to deal with the moisture so we don't contribute to the runoff problem. That's a totally different way of approaching development. We need to do it. That's endorsed in the action agenda. Not a lot of specifics about how we're going to get there. And then we need to retrofit or kind of go back into our existing cities and increase the ability of our existing paved over landscape to absorb and deal with stormwater. A lot of creative things can be done. It's mostly a matter of funding it and doing it.
Looking at this plan so far, to what extent does it exhibit progress over the plans that have come before?
Well, I think to me, the most important part of that isn't so much the list of things, the action items in the plan. I think we've had a number of excellent plans, and this is another plan that's good. It's the how part. It's the getting it funded and the who's supposed to do what by when part. That's the part that will distinguish this plan from others. And we're not there yet. That's the part that is yet to come. So I think this action agenda, it's good that they did all the work that they did. They got to the point where we are today with this agenda that we can work from. And, you know, we can quibble about some of the details. But the important part is the work to be done. And that's getting the money and getting the implementation, you know, the doing it part. That's what we haven't been able to do in the past. A lot of good things have happened, but in terms of overall making progress, it's the doing it part that seems so difficult. So I think this is a good plan. I applaud it. I'm glad they finished it. It clears the way to move to those issues of getting it done. But I won't say that this plan is better than any other until we get to the point of actually seeing it being implemented.
How is the implementation being organized?
So this is part of what isn't completely clear yet, but one of the things that's a step of progress is that the Puget Sound Partnership, which is a state agency, is working much more closely than any of its predecessor agencies in making sure that the state budget reflects the action agenda. So I think that we'll see in the state budget, I think we'll see a tight connection between what's being proposed in the state budget and what has to happen under the action agenda. We will also see a state budget that we will hate because the cuts are so deep in the agencies, in all the agencies, including those like the Department of Ecology, that have to play a key role here. But I think it is fair to say, and it's a welcome change, that the Puget Sound agenda is being taken seriously as a guide to what the budget ought to be.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kathy Fletcher, founder and executive director of People for Puget Sound. Our topic is the Puget Sound Partnership Action Agenda, a strategy for cleaning up, restoring, and protecting Puget Sound by 2020. Looking at what's proposed in the plan, are there adequate human and financial resources available to make it come to be?
One of the weaknesses of the plan is the funding strategy. There are a few things in there that have promise. The action agenda lays out a few sources of funding that will contribute to implementing the first stages of this action agenda. But the long-term funding and the additional revenues that will be needed to do the job right are not laid out there. There's one proposal, this is very interesting. They are going to propose some kind of 12-county taxing district as basically the funding structure for Puget Sound. And I think that they are loosely modeling this after the regional transportation strategies that we've been working on now for quite a few years here in the region. And they'll be asking the legislature to authorize the creation of this 12-county structure. It's going to be an interesting discussion because, first of all, how do you structure that? How do you get 12 counties moving in the same direction? I know it's a challenge to get three counties moving in the same direction. So 12, that's a pretty challenging thing. But that is one proposal in the action agenda to begin to address this issue of longer term funding.
Are there other proposals?
No. And I think that really no later than this upcoming legislative session that's about to start, we're going to have to be talking about that, because the huge cuts that we anticipate in the budget overall are going to raise fundamental questions about how do we pay for and sustain the things that need doing, not only to protect and restore the air and the water, but our health and human services and education systems. Everyone's going to be asking, how can we come up with a system that is more sustainable, and what long-term funding options can we reach enough support for in our state so that we don't have this kind of boom-bust cycle with our critical programs. So we, the environmental groups, are looking closely at some creative funding options that would enhance the state's ability to pay for clean water in particular. And, you know, there are a lot of permits and authorizations to pollute the water that have fees associated with them, and the fees are pretty minimal. And maybe those fees should be considered a source of revenue.
How many total dollars are likely to be required to put the action agenda into place?
Well, that is more than the $64,000 question. That is a huge and important, critical question. And it's interesting, the partnership decided not to answer that. They decided in part that they couldn't give a very good answer because it depends on what strategies are implemented. As David Dix, the director of the partnership, said the other day, if you go with a regulatory strategy as your dominant way of getting things done, that doesn't cost as much as if you go the incentive route. And so there's a range of numbers. All in all, I think that the partnership has decided not to put a really big number out there because they don't want to scare people. They want to do this on a more incremental basis.
How much do you think can be accomplished by better organizing and coordinating efforts that are already in place as opposed to just putting in new money?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for supporting and coordinating the efforts that are out there and having a better sense of priorities. The partnership has talked about this a lot. I think this goes, in my mind, especially to the need to support the ongoing activities as well as coordinate them. I don't think that there's a lot of wasted effort going on out there, but I do think that with some additional resources that all of the actors, be they nonprofit organizations or agencies or local governments, that all the actors are going to be much more willing to fall in line with a sense of priorities from the state level if there's some additional resources to do the work. You know, there's been a lot said about how we may be wasting money out there on Puget Sound. I don't see a lot of that. I see a lot of not doing enough. I don't see a lot of doing things that don't help in the area of cleaning up and protecting the sound. Where we're spending money that's not doing the job is we're spending money on projects, be they transportation projects or development projects, some private sector money, obviously. We're spending money that are resulting in further damage to Puget Sound. So if I were going to be more efficient about the money for Puget Sound, I would look to where we're spending money that's actually destroying the sound.
In your view, how effective is the action agenda likely to be? If the plan is put into place, are we likely to save Puget Sound?
Well, I think the jury is still out on that, because I think it depends completely on whether the funding and the accountability, namely the agreement that this or that agency or level of government is going to do this by a certain time, and here's how we're going to measure it. When those things are put in place, then I'll be able to answer your question. Right now, we've got the action agenda, but we don't really see how it's going to happen. And this isn't news to anybody. This is the critical unfinished piece of business.
What will be the very next steps? Where will the efforts be focused in the winter and spring of 2009? You've alluded to this a bit. But
yes. The big next step is the upcoming legislative session. The legislature will be deciding on funding issues, and they will be deciding maybe on this 12-county taxing district strategy. The legislature may also be getting into some of the policy issues raised by the partnership and others. For example, the partnership has proposed tightening up on the Shoreline Management Act in a key respect to make sure that we're doing a better job of protecting the shorelines from further damage. So legislature, that's the big action for the next several months.
What can individuals do to support the Puget Sound Partnership Action Agenda?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, people should realize this is an ongoing process and there's a lot at stake. And if people are interested in making sure that this happens as well as it possibly can be, they should do a couple of things. First of all, I would really hope people would join People for Puget Sound and get involved in our organization, because we are not only making sure that our members and others know what's going on and where to weigh in and how, but we also offer a chance for people to get their hands dirty and actually do something for Puget Sound. While all the decision makers are talking at the big scale, we're also out there actually restoring habitat, and there's plenty for people to do. We also, both the partnership and People for Puget Sound, are really big on people understanding that they have a responsibility in how they carry out their own lives and the decisions they make at home or at work. We're all having an effect on Puget Sound, and we can all make that effect less by, you know, not using toxic chemicals and by driving less and, you know, the usual list of the things that we can do for a more sustainable world. These are the things that will help Puget Sound on an individual basis. They're important things. I stress, however, that if we're serious about protecting and restoring Puget Sound, we've got to move on the big things. We've got to get our decision makers moving in the right direction. So I continue to think that we shouldn't all believe that, well, if we just don't use pesticides in our yard, that's going to do the job. That's necessary, but not sufficient.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the message I'd like to leave everybody with is a lot's been said about how the public doesn't understand that Puget Sound is in a dire strait. And it's true. It's beautiful to look at. It's still unbelievably productive. And you can eat a delicious oyster, or you can walk down at low tide and see an amazing array of creepy, crawly, wonderful creatures. Puget Sound is still fabulous. But I want people to leave this program understanding that it is in crisis. And maybe they can play a role in helping to spread that word. But don't stop there. That's the doom and gloom part. The hopeful part is that we can all do something about it. And whether that's getting involved with People for Puget Sound, or educating friends, neighbors, kids, or doing things at home that make a difference. These are things we can all contribute to the solution.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Kathy.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Kathy Fletcher, founder and executive director of People for Puget Sound. For more information, check on the web at www.pugetsound.org. And that's the website for the People for Puget Sound. And for the Puget Sound Partnership, the website is psp.wa.gov. Again, pugetsound.org and psp.wa.gov. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.